It was also on day four that someone from the outside world finally paid him attention. Late in the evening, when everybody else was asleep, a detachment of guards dragged him into a smaller, crudely lit cell. He was strapped down, not unkindly, to a table. From the moment he'd been grabbed, he'd not stopped speaking.
"This is all a misunderstanding. Please, I come from a very respectable family. You have to communicate with my wife and my lawyers. They will be able to clear this up. I cannot believe that I've been treated so despicably. I demand that the officer in charge hear my complaints."
He couldn't get the words out of his mouth fast enough. It wasn't until he noticed the electrical contraption that the guards were fiddling with in the corner that he fell quiet. Abelard stared at it with a terrible dread, and then, because he suffered from an insatiable urge to taxonomize, asked,
"What in God's name do you call that?"
"We call it the pulpo," one of the guards said. They spent all night showing him how it worked.
It was 3 days before Socorro could track down her husband, and another 5 days before she received permission from the capital to visit. The visiting room where Socorro awaited her husband seemed to have been fashioned from a latrine. There was only one sputtering kerosene lamp, and it looked as though a number of people had taken mountainous shits in the corner. An intentional humiliation that was lost on Socorro. She was too overwrought to notice. After what felt like an hour, again, another señora would have protested, but Socorro bore the shit smell and the darkness and the no chair stoically. Abelard was brought in handcuffed. He'd been given an undersized shirt and an undersized pair of pants. He was shuffling as though afraid that something in his hands or in his pockets might fall out. Only been inside a week, but already he looked frightful. His eyes were blackened, his hands and neck covered in bruises, and his torn lip had swollen monstrously, was the color of the meat inside your eye. The night before, he'd been interrogated by the guards, and they'd beaten him mercilessly with leather truncheons. One of his testicles would be permanently shriveled from the blows. Poor Socorro. Here was a woman whose lifelong preoccupation had been calamity. Her mother was a mute. Her drunk father frittered away the family's middle-class patrimony, one tarea at a time, until their holdings had been reduced to a shack and some chickens, and the old man was forced to work other people's land, condemned to a life of constant movement, poor health, and broken hands. It was said that Pa Socorro had never recovered from seeing his own father beaten to death by a neighbor who also happened to be a sergeant in the police. Socorro's childhood had been about missed meals and cousin clothes, about seeing her father 3-4 times a year, visits where he didn't talk to anybody, just lay in his room drunk. Socorro became an anxious muchacha. For a time she thinned her hair by pulling it, was 17 when she caught Abelard's eye in a training hospital, but didn't start menstruating until a year after they were married. Even as an adult, Socorro was in the habit of waking up in the middle of the night in terror, convinced that the house was on fire, would rush from room to room, expecting to be greeted by a carnival of flame. When Abelard read to her from his newspapers, she took special interest in earthquakes and fires and floods and cattle stampedes and the sinking of ships. She was the family's first catastrophist. Would have made Cuvier proud. What had she been expecting while she fiddled with the buttons on her dress, while she shifted the purse on her shoulder and tried not to unbalance her Macy's hat? A mess. Un toyo certainly, but not a husband looking nearly destroyed, who shuffled like an old man, whose eyes shone with a sort of fear that isn't easily shed. It was worse than she in all her apocalyptic fervor had imagined. It was the fall. When she placed her hands on Abelard, he began to cry very loudly, very shamefully. tears streamed down his face as he tried to tell her all that had happened to him. It wasn't long after that visit that Socorro realized that she was pregnant, with Abelard's third and final daughter. Safa or Fuku? You tell me. There would always be speculation. At the most basic level, did he say it, did he not? Which is another way of asking, did he have a hand in his own destruction? Even the family was divided. La Inca, adamant that her cousin had said nothing. It had all been a setup, orchestrated by Abelard's enemies to strip the family of their wealth, their properties, and their businesses. Others were not so sure. He probably had said something that night at the club, and, unfortunately for him, he'd been overheard by the Jefe's agents. No elaborate plot, just drunken stupidity. As for the carnage that followed, qué sé yo? Just a lot of bad luck. Most of the folks you speak to prefer the story with a supernatural twist. They believe that not only did Trujillo want Abelard's daughter, but when he couldn't snatch her, out of spite, he put a fuku on the family's ass. Which is why all the terrible shit that happened happened. So which was it, you ask? An accident, a conspiracy, or a fuku? The only answer I can give you is the least satisfying. You'll have to decide for yourself. What's certain is that nothing's certain. We are trawling in silences here. Trujillo and company didn't leave a paper trail. They didn't share their German contemporaries' lust for documentation. And it's not like the fuku itself would leave a memoir or anything. The remaining Cabrals ain't much help either, on all matters related to Abelard's imprisonment and to the subsequent destruction of the clan. There is within the family a silence that stands monument to the generations. That sphinxes all attempts at narrative reconstruction. A whisper here and there, but nothing more. Which is to say, if you're looking for a full story, I don't have it. Oscar searched for it too, in his last days, and it's not certain whether he found it either. Let's be honest, though. The rap about the girl Trujillo wanted is a pretty common one on the island. As common as krill. Not that krill is too common on the island, but you get the drift. So common that Mario Vargas Llosa didn't have to do much except open his mouth to sift it out of the air. There's one of these bellaco tales in almost everybody's hometown. It's one of those easy stories because, in essence, it explains it all. Trujillo took your houses, your properties, put your pops and your moms in jail? Well, it was because he wanted to fuck the beautiful daughter of the house. And your family wouldn't let him. Anacaona, a.k.a. the Golden Flower. One of the founding mothers of the New World and the most beautiful Indian in the world. The Mexicans might have their Malinche, but we Dominicans have our Anacaona. Anacaona was the wife of Caonabo, one of the five caciques who ruled our island at the time of the discovery. In his accounts, Bartolomé de las Casas described her as a woman of great prudence and authority, very courtly and gracious in her manner of speaking and her gestures. Other witnesses put it more succinctly. The chick was hot, and it would turn out warrior brave. When the Euro started going Hannibal Lecter on the Taínos, they killed Anacaona's husband, which is another story. And like all good warrior women, she tried to rally her people, tried to resist, but the Europeans were the original fuku, no stopping them. Massacre after massacre after massacre. Upon being captured, Anacaona tried to parley, saying, "Killing is not honorable. Neither does violence redress our honor. Let us build a bridge of love that our enemies may cross, leaving their footprints for all to see." The Spanish weren't trying to build no bridges, though.
After a bogus trial, they hung brave Anacaona. In Santo Domingo. In the shadow of one of our first churches. The end. A common story you hear about Anacaona and the DR is that, on the eve of her execution, she was offered a chance to save herself. All she had to do was marry a Spaniard who was obsessed with her. See the trend? Trujillo wanted the Mirabal sisters, and the Spaniard wanted Anacaona. Offer that choice to a contemporary island girl, and see how fast she fills out that passport application. Anacaona, however, tragically old school, was reported to have said, "White man, kiss my hurricane ass." And that was the end of Anacaona, the golden flower. One of the founding mothers of the New World and the most beautiful Indian in the world. Shit really is perfect. Makes for plenty of fun reading. But there's another less known variant of the Abelard versus Trujillo narrative. A secret history that claims that Abelard didn't get in trouble because of his daughter's culo, or because of an imprudent joke. This version contends that he got in trouble because of a book. Cue the theremin, please. Sometime in 1944, so the story goes, while Abelard was still worried about whether he was in trouble with Trujillo, he started writing a book about, what else? Trujillo. By 1945, there was already a tradition of ex-officials writing tell-all books about the Trujillo regime. But that apparently was not the kind of book Abelard was writing. His shit, if we're to believe the whispers, was an exposé of the supernatural roots of the Trujillo regime. A book about the dark powers of the president. A book in which Abelard argued that the tales the common people told about the president, that he was supernatural, that he was not human, may in some ways have been true. That it was possible that Trujillo was, if not in fact, then in principle, a creature from another world. I only wish I could have read that thing. I know Oscar did too. That shit would have been one wild motherfucking riot. Alas, the grimoire in question, so the story goes, was conveniently destroyed after Abelard was arrested. No copy survive. Not his wife or his children knew about its existence either. Only one of the servants who helped him collect the folk tales on the sly, etc., etc. What can I tell you? In Santo Domingo, a story is not a story unless it casts a supernatural shadow. It was one of those fictions with a lot of disseminators but no believers. Oscar, as you might imagine, found this version of the fall very, very attractive. Appealed to the deep structures in his nerd brain. Mysterious books. A supernatural, or perhaps alien dictator, who'd installed himself on the first island of the New World and then cut it off from everything else. Who could send a curse to destroy his enemies. That was some New Age Lovecraft shit. The Lost Final Book of Dr. Abelard Luis Cabral. I'm sure that this is nothing more than a figment of our island's hypertrophied voodoo imagination, and nothing less. The girl Trujillo wanted might be trite as far as foundation myths go, but at least it's something you can really believe in, no? Something real. Strange, though, that when all was said and done, Trujillo never went after Jackie, even though he had Abelard in his grasp. He was known to be unpredictable, but still. It's odd, isn't it? Also strange that none of Abelard's books, not the four he authored, or the hundreds he owned, survive. Not in an archive, not in a private collection, not a one. All of them either lost or destroyed. Every paper he had in his house was confiscated and reportedly burned. You want creepy? Not one single example of his handwriting remains. I mean, okay, Trujillo was thorough. But not one scrap of paper with his handwriting? That was more than thorough.
You gotta fear a motherfucker or what he's writing to do something like that.
But hey, it's only a story, with no solid evidence. The kind of shit only a nerd could love.
The sentence. No matter what you believe, in February 1946, Abelard was officially convicted of all charges and sentenced to 18 years. 18 years. Gaunt Abelard dragged from the courtroom before he could say a word. Socorro, immensely pregnant, had to be restrained from attacking the judge. Maybe you'll ask, why was there no outcry in the papers? No actions among the civil rights groups? No opposition parties rallying to the cause? Nigger, please. There were no papers, no civil rights groups, no opposition parties. There was only Trujillo. And talk about jurisprudence. Abelard's lawyer got one phone call from the Palacio and promptly dropped the appeal.
It's better we say nothing, he advised Socorro. He'll live longer.
Say nothing, say everything, it didn't matter. It was the fall. The 14-room house in La Vega. The luxurious apartment in Santiago. The stables in which you could comfortably billet a dozen horses. The two prosperous supermercados and the string of fincas vanished in the detonation. Were all confiscated by the Trujillato. And ended up dispersed among the jefe and his minions, two of whom had been out with Abelard the night he said the bad thing. I could reveal their names, but I believe you already know one of them. He was a certain trusted neighbor. But no disappearance was more total, more ultimate, than Abelard's. Losing your house and all your properties, that was par for the course with the Trujillato. But the arrest, if you're more into the fantastic, that book, precipitated an unprecedented downturn in the family fortune. Tripped at some cosmic level, a lever against the family. Call it a whole lot of bad luck, outstanding karmic debt, or something else. Fuku. Whatever it was, the shit started coming at the family something awful. And there are some people who would say, it's never ever stopped.
Fallout. The family claims the first sign was that Abelard's third and final daughter, given the light early on in her father's capsulization, was born black. And not just any kind of black, but black black. Congo black, Shango black, Cali black, Zapote black, Reca black, and no amount of fancy Dominican racial ledger domain was going to obscure the fact. That's the kind of culture I belong to. People took their child's black complexion as an ill omen. You want a real first sign? Not 2 months after giving birth to the third and final daughter, who was named Hipatia Belicia Cabral, Socorro, perhaps blinded by her grief, by her husband's disappearance, by the fact that all her husband's family had begun avoiding them like, well, a fuku, by postpartum depression, stepped in front of a speeding ammunition truck and was dragged nearly to the front of La Casa Amarilla before the driver realized something was wrong. If she wasn't dead on impact, she was certainly dead by the time they pried her body from the truck's axles. It was the very worst kind of luck. But what could be done? With a dead mom and a dad in prison, with the rest of the family scarce, and I mean Trujillo scarce, the daughters had to be divvied up among whoever would take them. Jackie got sent to her wealthy godparents in La Capital, while Astrid ended up with relatives in San Juan de la Maguana. They never saw each other or their father again. Even those among you who don't believe in fukus of any kind might have wondered what in creation's name was going on. Shortly after Socorro's horrible accident, Esteban de Gallo, the family's number one servant, was fatally stabbed outside a cabaret. The attackers were never found. Lydia perished soon after, some say of grief, others of a cancer in her womanly parts. Her body was not found for months. After all, she lived alone. In 1948, Jackie, the family's golden child, was found drowned in her godparents' pool. The pool that had been drained down to its last 2 feet of water. Up to that point, she'd been unflaggingly cheerful. The sort of talkative negra who could have found a positive side to a mustard gas attack. Despite her traumas, despite the circumstances around her separation from her parents, she disappointed no one, exceeded all expectations. She was number one in her class academically, beating out even the private school children of the American colony, so off-the-hook intelligent she made a habit of correcting her teacher's mistakes on exams. She was captain of the debate team, captain of the swim team, and in tennis, had no equal, was fucking golden. But never got over the fall or her role in it, was how people explained it. Though, how odd is it that she was accepted to medical school in France 3 days before she killed herself, and from all evidence, couldn't wait to be gone from Santo Domingo. Her sister Astrid, "We scarcely knew you, babe," wasn't much luckier. In 1951, while praying in a church in San Juan, where she lived with her tios, a stray bullet flew down the aisle and struck her in the back of the head, killing her instantly. No one knew where the bullet had come from. No one even recalled hearing a weapon discharge. Of the original family quartet, Abelard lived the longest, which is ironic, since nearly everyone in his circle, including La Inca, believed the government when they announced in 1953 that he was dead. Why did they do this? Because. It was only after he died for real that it was revealed that he'd been in Nigua prison all along, served 14 straight years in Trujillo's justice. What a nightmare. 1,000 tales I could tell you about Abelard's imprisonment. 1,000 tales to wring the salt from your motherfucking eyes. But I'm going to spare you the anguish, the torture, the loneliness, and the sickness of those 14 wasted years. Spare you, in fact, the events, and leave you with only the consequences. And you should wonder rightly if I've spared you anything. Nigua y el Pozo de Nagua were death camps. Ultamos, considered the worst prisons in the New World. Most niggers who ended up in Nigua during the Trujillato never left alive. And those who did probably wished they hadn't. The father of one of my friends spent 8 years in Nigua for failing to show proper deference toward the Jefe's father. And he once spoke of a fellow prisoner who made the mistake of complaining to his jailers about a toothache. The guards shoved a gun in his mouth and blew his brains into orbit. "I bet it don't hurt now," the guards guffawed. The one who actually committed the murder was known thereafter as El Dentista. Nigua had many famous alumni, including the writer Juan Bosch, who would go on to become exiled anti-Trujillista number one, and eventually president of the Dominican Republic. As Juan Isidro Jiménez Grullón said in his book Una Gestapo en América, "Es mejor tener 100 niguas en un pie que un pie nigua." In 1960, at the height of the clandestine resistance movement against Trujillo, Abelard underwent a particularly gruesome procedure. He was manacled to a chair, placed out in the scorching sun, and then a wet rope was cinched cruelly about his forehead. It was called La Corona, a simple but horribly effective torture. At first the rope just grips your skull, but as the sun dries and tightens it, the pain becomes unbearable, would drive you mad. Among the prisoners of the Trujillato, few tortures were more feared. since it neither killed you nor left you alive. Abelard survived it but was never the same. Turned him into a vegetable. The proud flame of his intellect extinguished. For the rest of his short life, he existed in an imbecilic stupor. But there were prisoners who remembered moments when he seemed almost lucid, when he would stand in the fields and stare at his hands and weep, as if recalling that there was once a time when he'd been more than this. The other prisoners, out of respect, continued to call him El Doctor. It was said he died a couple of days before Trujillo was assassinated, buried in an unmarked grave somewhere outside of Nigua. Oscar visited the site on his last days. Nothing to report. Looked like every other scrappy field in Santo Domingo. He burned candles, left flowers, prayed, and went back to his hotel. The government was supposed to have erected a plaque to the dead of Nigua prison. But they never did. The third and final daughter. What about the third and final daughter, Hipatia Belicia Cabral, who was only 2 months old when her mother died, who never met her father, who was held by her sisters only a few times before they too disappeared, who spent no time inside Casa Atuay, who was the literal child of the apocalypse? What about her? She was not as easy to place as Astrid or Jackie. She was a newborn, after all, and, well, the scuttlebutt around the family has it that as she was so dark, no one on Abelard's side of the family would take her. To make matters worse, she was born Bakini, underweight, sickly. She had problems crying, problems nursing, and no one outside the family wanted the dark child to live. I know it's taboo to make this accusation, but I doubt that anybody inside the family wanted her to live either. For a couple of weeks it was touch and go, and if it hadn't been for a kindly dark-skinned woman named Zoila, who gave her some of her own baby's breast milk and held her for hours a day, she probably wouldn't have made it. By the end of her fourth month, the baby seemed to be staging a comeback. She was still Bakini Central, but she was starting to put on weight, and her crying, which before had sounded like a murmur from the grave, was growing more and more piercing. Zoila, who'd become a guardian angel of sorts, stroked the baby's mottled head and declared, "Another 6 months, mijita, and you'll be más fuerte que Lilis." Belly didn't have 6 months. Stability was not in our girl's stars, only change. Without any warning, a group of Socorro's distant relatives showed up and claimed the child, tore her clean out of Zoila's arms, the very same relatives Socorro had happily put behind her when she married Abelard. I suspect these people hadn't actually intended to take care of the girl for any length of time, were only doing it because they expected some monetary reward from the Cabrals. And when no loot was forthcoming, the fall was total. The Brutos passed the girl on to some even more distant relatives on the outskirts of Asua. And here's where the trail gets funky. These people in Asua seem to be some real whack jobs, what my mom calls salvages. After only a month of caring for the unhappy infant, the moms of the family disappeared one afternoon with the baby, and when she returned to her village, the baby didn't. She told her vecinos that the baby had died. Some people believed her. Belly, after all, had been ailing for a while. The tiniest little negrita on the planet, Fuku Part 3. But most folks figured that she had sold the girl to some other family. Back then, as now, the buying and selling of children, common enough. And that's exactly what happened. Like a character in one of Oscar's fantasy books. The orphan, who may or may not have been the object of a supernatural vendetta, was sold to complete strangers in another part of Asua. That's right. She was sold. Became a criada. Arestavec. Lived anonymously among the poorest sectors on the island, never knowing who her real people were. And subsequently, she was lost from sight for a long, long time. I lived in Santo Domingo only until I was 9, and even I knew criadas. Two of them lived in the callejón behind our house, and these girls were the most demolished, overworked human beings I'd known at that time. One girl, Solveida, did all the cooking, all the cleaning, fetched all the water, and took care of two infants for a family of 8. And Chiqui was only 7 years old. She never went to school, and if my brother's first girlfriend, Joanna, hadn't taken the time, stolen behind her people's back, to teach her ABCs, she wouldn't have known nada. Every year I came home from the States, it was the same thing. Quiet, hard-working Solveida would stop in for a second to say a word to my abuelo and my mother, and also to watch a couple of minutes of a novela, before rushing off to finish her next chore. My mother always brought her a gift of cash. The one time she brought her a dress, her people were wearing it the next day. I tried to talk to her, of course, Mr. Community Activist, but she would skitter away from me and my stupid questions. "What can you two talk about?" my mom's demanded. "La pobrecita can't even write her own name." And then, when she was 15, one of the callejón idiots knocked her up. And now, my mother tells me, the family has got her kid working for them too, bringing in the water for his mother. The Burning. The next time Belly appears is in 1955, as a whisper in La Inca's ear. I think we should be very clear and very honest about La Inca's disposition during the period we've been calling the Fall. Despite some claims that she was living in exile in Puerto Rico during the fall, La Inca was in fact in Baní, isolated from her family, mourning the death of her husband 3 years earlier. Points of clarification for the conspiracy-minded? His death occurred before the fall, so he was definitely not a victim of it. Those early years of her mourning had been bad. Her hubby, the only person she'd ever loved, who'd ever really loved her, and they'd only been married months before he passed. She was lost in the wilderness of her grief. So when word came down that her cousin Abelard was in big trouble with Trujillo, La Inca, to her undying shame, did nothing. She was in such pain. What could she have done? When news reached her of the death of Socorro and the dispersal of the daughters, she still, to her everlasting shame, did nothing. Let the rest of the family figure it out. It wasn't until she heard that both Jackie and Astrid had passed that she finally pulled herself out of her malaise long enough to realize that dead husband or no dead husband, mourning or no mourning, she had failed utterly in her responsibility toward her cousin, who'd always been kind to her, and who'd supported her marriage when the rest of the family did not. This revelation both shamed and mortified La Inca. She got herself cleaned up and went looking for the third and final daughter. But when she got to the family in Asua that had bought the girl, they showed her a little grave, and that was it. She had powerful suspicions about this evil family, about the girl. But since she wasn't a psychic or a CSI, there was nothing she could do. She had to accept that the girl had perished, and that it was in part her fault. One good thing about that shame and that guilt: it blew her out of her mourning. She came back to life, opened up a string of bakeries, dedicated herself to serving her customers. Every now and then would dream about the little Negrita, the last of her dead cousin's seed. "Hi, tía," the girl would say, and La Inca would wake up with a knot in her chest. And then it was 1955, the year of the benefactor. La Inca's bakeries were kicking ass. She'd reestablished herself as a presence in her town, when one fine day, she heard an astonishing tale. It seems that a little campesina girl living in Outer Asua had tried to attend the new rural school that Trujillato had built out there, but her parents, who weren't her parents, didn't want her to attend,
The girl, though, was immensely stubborn, and the parents who weren't her parents flipped when the girl kept skipping out on work to attend classes. And in the ensuing brawl, the poor muchachita got burned horribly. The father, who was not her father, splashed a pan of hot oil on her naked back, the burn nearly killing her. In Santo Domingo, good news might travel like thunder, but bad news travels like light. And the wildest part of the story? Rumor had it that this burned girl was a relative of La Inca. How could that be possible? La Inca demanded. Do you remember your cousin who was the doctor up in La Vega? The one who went to prison for saying the bad thing about Trujillo? Well, Fulano, who knows Fulano, who knows Fulano, said that that little girl is his daughter. For 2 days, she didn't want to believe. People were always starting rumors about everything in Santo Domingo. Didn't want to believe that the girl could have survived, could be alive in Outer Asua, of all places. For 2 nights, she slept poorly, had to medicate herself with Mama Juana, and finally, after dreaming of her dead husband and as much to settle her own conscience as anything, La Inca asked her neighbor and number one dough kneader, Carlos Moya, the man who'd once kneaded her dough before running off and getting married, to drive her to where this girl was supposed to live. If she's my cousin's daughter, I will know her just by looking at her, she announced. 24 hours later, La Inca returned with an impossibly tall, impossibly skinny, half-dead Belicia in tow. La Inca's mind firmly and permanently set against both campos and their inhabitants. Not only had these savages burned the girl, they proceeded to punish her further by locking her in a chicken coop at night. At first, they hadn't wanted to bring her out. She can't be your family, she's a prieta. But La Inca insisted, used the voice on them. And when the girl emerged from the coop, unable to unbend her body because of the burn, La Inca had stared into her wild, furious eyes and seen Abelard and Socorro staring back at her. Forget the black skin. It was her, the third and final daughter. Thought lost, now found.
I am your real family, La Inca said forcefully. I am here to save you.
And so, in a heartbeat, by a whisper, were two lives irrevocably changed. La Inca installed Belly in the spare room in her house where her husband had once taken his naps and worked on his carvings, filed the paperwork to give the girl an identity, called in the doctors. The girl's burns were unbelievably savage. 110 hit points minimum. A monster glove of festering ruination extending from the back of her neck to the base of her spine. A bomb crater. A world scar like those of a Ibakusha. As soon as she could wear real clothes again, La Inca dressed the girl and had her first real photo taken out in front of the house.
Here she is.
Ipatia Belicia Cabral, the third and final daughter. Suspicious, angry, scowling, uncommunicative, a wounded, hungering campesina, but with an expression and posture that shouted in bold Gothic letters, defiant. Dark-skinned, but clearly her family's daughter. Of this there was no doubt. Already taller than Jackie in her prime, her eyes exactly the same color as those of the father she knew nothing about.
End of Disc 7.
Forget Me Not. Of those 9 years, and of the burning, Belly did not speak. It seems that as soon as her days in Outer Asua were over, as soon as she reached Vani, that entire chapter of her life got slopped into those containers in which governments store nuclear waste, triple-sealed by industrial lasers and deposited in the dark, uncharted trenches of her soul. It says a lot about Belly that for 40 years she never leaked word one about that period of her life. Not to her madre,
not to her friends, not to her lovers, not to the gangster, not to her husband, and certainly not to her beloved children, Lola and Oscar. 40 years. What little anyone knows about Belly's Aswa days comes exclusively from what La Inca heard the day she rescued Belly from her so-called parents. Even today, La Inca rarely sang anything more than, "Casi la acabaron." In fact, I believe that, barring a couple of key moments, Belly never thought about that life again. Embraced the amnesia that was so common throughout the islands, 5 parts denial, 5 parts negative hallucination. Embraced the power of the Antilles, and from it, forged herself anew. Sanctuary. But enough. What matters is that in Bani, in La Inca's house, Belicia Cabral found sanctuary. And in La Inca, the mother she never had. Taught the girl to read, write, dress, eat, behave normally. La Inca, a finishing school on fast forward. For here was a woman with a civilizing mission. A woman driven by her own colossal feelings of guilt, betrayal, and failure. And Belly, despite all that she's endured, or perhaps because of it, turned out to be a most apt pupil. Took to La Inca's civilizing procedures like a mongoose to chicken. By the end of Sanctuary's first year, Belly's rough lines had been kneaded out. She might have cursed more, had more of a temper, her movements more aggressive and unrestrained, had the merciless eyes of a falcon, but she had the posture and speech and arrogance of una muchacha respetable. And when she wore long sleeves, the scar was only visible on her neck, the edge of a larger ruination certainly, but greatly reduced by the cut of the cloth. This was the girl who would travel to the U.S. in 1962, whom Oscar and Lola would never know. La Inca, the only one to have seen Belly at her beginnings, when she slept fully dressed and screamed in the middle of the night, who saw her before she constructed a better self, one with Victorian table manners and a disgust of filth and poor people. Theirs, as you might imagine, was an odd relationship. La Inca never sought to discuss Belly's time in Aswa, would never refer to it, or to the burning. She pretended it didn't exist, the same way she pretended that the poor slobs in her barrio didn't exist when they in fact were overrunning the place. Even when she greased the girl's back every morning and every night, La Inca only said, "Siéntese aquí, señorita." It was a silence, a lack of probing, that Belly found most agreeable. If only the waves of feeling that would occasionally lap her back could be so easily forgotten. Instead of talking about the burning or outer Aswa, La Inca talked to Belly about her lost, forgotten past, about her father, the famous doctor, about her mother, the beautiful nurse, about her sisters Jackie and Astrid, and about that marvelous castle in the Cibao, Casa Atuay. They may never have become best friends, Belly too furious, La Inca too correct, but La Inca did give Belly the greatest of gifts, which she would appreciate only much later. One night, La Inca produced an old newspaper, pointed to a photograph. "This," she said, "is your father and your mother. This," she said, "is who you are." The day they opened their clinic, so young, both of them looking so serious. For Belly, those months truly were her one and only sanctuary, a world of safety she never thought possible. She had clothes, she had food, she had time, and La Inca never ever yelled at her. Not for nothing. And didn't let anybody else yell at her either. Before La Inca enrolled her in Colegio El Redentor with the Richies, Belly attended the dusty, fly-infested public school
with children 3 years younger than her. Made no friends. She couldn't have imagined it any other way. And for the first time in her life, began to remember her dreams. It was a luxury she'd never dared indulge in. And in the beginning, they seemed as powerful as storms. She had the whole variety, from flying to being lost, and even dreamt about the burning. How her father's face had turned blank at the moment he picked up the skillet. In her dreams, she was never scared, would only shake her head. "You're gone," she said. "No more." There was a dream, however, that did haunt her, where she walked alone through a vast empty house whose roof was being tattooed by rain. Whose house was it? She hadn't a clue. But she could hear the voices of children in it. At first year's end, the teacher asked her to come to the board and fill in the date, a privilege that only the best children in the class were given. She is a giant at the board, and in their minds, the children are calling her what they call her in the world. Variations on La Prieta Quemada, or La Fea Quemada. When Belly sat down, the teacher glanced over her scrawl and said, "Well done, Señorita Cabral." She would never forget that day, even when she became the Queen of Diaspora. "Well done, Señorita Cabral." She would never forget. She was 9 years, 11 months. It was the era of Trujillo. Chapter 6. Land of the Lost, 1992 to 1995. The Dark Age. After graduation, Oscar moved back home. Left a virgin, returned one. Took down his childhood posters, Star Blazers, Captain Harlock, and tacked up his college ones, Akira and Terminator 2. Now that Reagan and the evil empire had ridden off into Never Never Land, Oscar didn't dream about the end no more. Only about the fall. He put away his aftermath game and picked up space opera. These were the early Clinton years, but the economy was still sucking an 80s cock, and he kicked around doing nada for almost 7 months, went back to subbing at Don Bosco whenever one of the teachers got sick. Oh, the irony. He started sending his stories and novels out, but no one seemed interested. Still, he kept trying and kept writing. A year later, the substituting turned into a full-time job. He could have refused, could have made a saving throw against torture, but instead he went with the flow. Watched his horizons collapse, told himself it didn't matter. Had Don Bosco, since last we visited, been miraculously transformed by the spirit of Christian brotherhood? Had the eternal benevolence of the Lord cleansed the students of their vile? Negro, please. Certainly the school struck Oscar as smaller now, and the older brothers all seemed to have acquired the Innsmouth look in the past 5 years, and there were a grip more kids of color. But some things, like white supremacy and people of color self-hate, never change. The same charge of gleeful sadism that he remembered from his youth still electrified the halls. And if he'd thought Don Bosco had been the moronic inferno when he was young, try now that he was older and teaching English and history. Jesus Santa Maria. A nightmare. He wasn't great at teaching. His heart wasn't in it. And boys of all grades and dispositions shitted on him effusively. Students laughed when they spotted him in the halls, pretended to hide their sandwiches, asked in the middle of lectures if he ever got laid, and no matter how he responded, they guffawed mercilessly. The students he knew laughed as much at his embarrassment as at the image they had of him crushing down on some hapless girl. They drew cartoons of said crushings, and Oscar found these on the floor after class, complete with dialogue bubbles. "No, Mr. Oscar, no!" How demoralizing was that?
Every day he watched the cool kids torture the crap out of the fat, the ugly, the smart, the poor, the dark, the black, the unpopular, the African, the Indian, the Arab, the immigrant, the strange, the femenino, the gay. And in every one of these clashes he saw himself. In the old days, it had been the white kids who'd been the chief tormentors. But now it was kids of color who performed the necessaries. Sometimes he tried to reach out to the school's whipping boys, offer them some words of comfort. You are not alone, you know, in this universe. But the last thing a freak wants is a helping hand from another freak. These boys fled from him in terror. In a burst of enthusiasm, he attempted to start a science fiction and fantasy club, posted signs up in the halls, and for 2 Thursdays in a row he sat in his classroom after school, his favorite books laid out in an attractive pattern, listened to the roar of receding footsteps in the halls, the occasional shout of "Beam me up" and "Nanu Nanu" outside his door. Then, after 30 minutes of nothing, he collected his books, locked the room, and walked down those same halls alone, his footsteps sounding strangely dainty. His only friend on the staff was another secular, a 29-year-old alterna Latina named Natalie. Yes, she reminded him of Jenny, minus the outrageous pulchritude, minus the smolder. Natalie had spent 4 years in a mental hospital, nerves, she said, and was an avowed Wiccan. Her boyfriend, Stan the Can, whom she'd met in the Nut House, our honeymoon, worked as an EMS technician. And Natalie told Oscar that the bodies Stan the Can saw splattered on the streets turned them on for some reason. Stan, he said, sounds like a very curious individual.
You can say that again,
Natalie sighed. Despite Natalie's homeliness and the medicated fog she inhabited, Oscar entertained some pretty strange Harold Lauder fantasies about her. Since she was not hot enough in his mind to date openly, he imagined them in one of those twisted bedroom-only relationships. He had these images of walking into her apartment and ordering her to undress and cook grits for him naked. 2 seconds later, she'd be kneeling on the tile of her kitchen in only an apron, while he remained fully clothed. From there, it only got weirder. At the end of his first year, Natalie, who used to sneak whiskey during breaks, who introduced him to Sandman and 8-Ball, and who borrowed a lot of money from him and never paid it back, transferred to Ridgewood. "Yahoo," she said in her usual deadpan. "The suburbs." And that was the end of their friendship. He tried calling a couple of times, but her paranoid boyfriend seemed to live with the phone welded to his head, never seemed to give her any of his messages, so he let it fade. Let it fade. Social life? Those first couple of years home, he didn't have one. Once a week, he drove out to Woodbridge Mall and checked the RPGs at the game room, the comic books at Heroes World, the fantasy novels at Walden Books, the nerd circuit. Stared at the toothpick-thin black girl who worked at the Friendlies, whom he was in love with, but with whom he would never speak. Alan Miggs hadn't chilled with them in a long time. They'd both dropped out of college, Monmouth and Jersey City State, respectively, and both had jobs at the Blockbuster across town. Probably both end up in the same grave. Maritza, he didn't see no more either. Heard she'd married a Cuban dude, lived in Teaneck, had a kid and everything. And Olga, nobody knew exactly. Rumor had it she tried to rob the local Safeway, Dana Plato style. Hadn't bothered to wear a mask even though everybody at the supermarket knew her. And there was talk that she was still in Middlesex. Wouldn't be getting out until they were all 50. No girls who loved him? No girls anywhere in his life? Not a one. At least at Rutgers, there'd been multitudes,
and an institutional pretense that allowed a mutant like him to approach without causing a panic. In the real world, it wasn't that simple. In the real world, girls turned away in disgust when he walked past, changed seats at the cinema. And one woman on the crosstown bus even told him to stop thinking about her.
"I know what you're up to," she'd hissed. "So stop it."
"I'm the permanent bachelor," he wrote in a letter to his sister, who'd abandoned Japan to come to New York to be with me.
"There's nothing permanent in the world," his sister wrote back. He pushed his fist into his eye, wrote, "There is in me."
The home life didn't kill him, but didn't sustain him either. His mom's thinner, quieter, less afflicted by the craziness of her youth. Still the work golem. Still allowed her Peruvian boarders to pack as many relatives as they wanted into the first floors. And Tio Rudolfo, Fofo to his friends, had relapsed to some of his hard pre-prison habits. He was on the caballo again, broke into lightning sweats at dinner, had moved into Lola's room, and now Oscar got to listen to him chicken-boning his stripper girlfriends almost every single night.
"Tio!" he yelled out once. "Less bass on the headboard, if you will!"
On the walls of his room, Tio Rudolfo hung pictures of his first years in the Bronx, when he'd been 16 and wearing all the fly Willy Colon pimp shit, before he'd gone off to Vietnam. Only Dominican, he claimed, in the whole damned armed forces. And there were pictures of Oscar's mom and dad, young, taken in the 2 years of their relationship. "You loved him," he said to her. She laughed. "Don't talk about what you know nothing about." On the outside, Oscar simply looked tired. No taller, no fatter. Only the skin under his eyes, pouched from years of quiet desperation, had changed. Inside, he was in a world of hurt. He saw black flashes before his eyes. He saw himself falling through the air. He knew what he was turning into. He was turning into the worst kind of human on the planet. An old, bitter dork. Saw himself at the game room, picking through the miniatures for the rest of his life. He didn't want this future, but he couldn't see how it could be avoided. Couldn't figure his way out of it.
Fuku. The darkness.
Some mornings he would wake up and not be able to get out of bed. Like he had a 10-ton weight on his chest. Like he was under acceleration forces. Would have been funny if it didn't hurt his heart so. Had dreams that he was wandering around the evil planet Gordo, searching for parts for his crashed rocket ship. But all he encountered were burned-out ruins, each seething with new debilitating forms of radiation. "I don't know what's wrong with me," he said to his sister over the phone. "I think the word is crisis, but every time I open my eyes, all I see is meltdown." This was when he threw students out of class for breathing, when he would tell his mother to fuck off, when he couldn't write a word, when he went into his Tio's closet and put the Colt up to his temple, when he thought about the train bridge. The days he lay in bed and thought about his mother fixing him his plate the rest of his life, what he'd heard her say to his Tio the other day when she thought he wasn't around. "I don't care. I'm happy he's here." Afterward, when he no longer felt like a whipped dog inside, when he could pick up a pen without wanting to cry, he would suffer from overwhelming feelings of guilt. He would apologize to his mother. "If there's a goodness part of my brain, it's like somebody had absconded with it." "It's okay, hijo," she said. He would take the car and visit Lola. After a year in Brooklyn, she was now in Washington Heights, was letting her hair grow. Had been pregnant once, a real moment of excitement, but she aborted it because I was cheating on her with some girl. "I have returned," he announced,
when he stepped in the door. She told him it was okay too, would cook for him